The Rebel Capitalist Show, episode 140.
Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show.
All right, guys, it gives me a great deal of pleasure to welcome someone to the Rebel Capitalist Show that I really look forward to. He is a rock star on FinTwit, and he's always recommended to me by guys like Brent Johnson, Mike Green, and Steve the Bond King. His name is Dr. Chris Dark. He is right here on the Rebel Capitalist Show. Dr. Chris, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much, George. Great to be here.
All right. Now, for my viewers who might not know your backstory, can you kind of go into that? You've got a very interesting background, and get us up to speed there.
Sure, no problem. So I'm British. I'll try not to do the whole 20 minutes of backstory thing. I'm originally a scientist. So I got a PhD in superconductors from Oxford University, and I started my first business then. I started one of the world's first esports businesses. So this was back in like 2002, 2001, when esports was very much not cool, and everyone thought I was insane. And I sort of did both. And then I went and worked at Bain & Company for a few years in London, and I was still kind of moonlighting with my esports thing, which was a relatively big site 20 years ago. And then ever since then, really, I've done entrepreneurial stuff. So started several businesses, had success, failure, the usual thing. And now I'm living out in Asia, in Hong Kong with my family, and pretty much retired, but I'd spend a lot of time looking into all the kind of interesting macro topics and trying to talk to people. But I'm a little different. I'm trying to talk to people who actually do whatever the topic is for a living, as opposed to talking to like an analyst who's trying to work things out. I want to speak to people who, you know, actually buy bonds from the Fed, for example, and to, you know, to try and really get under the hood. So, and I'm really candid. So I will give yes, no answers, but also elaborate much more. So if I think something's a yes or a no, I will just say it. And by the way, some people will hate that, especially if we get on to talk about reserves. So.
they're going to love the conversation and the honest answers, that's for sure. So what got you into macro and investing? Because you're just like me, your background's really entrepreneurship.
Yeah, I mean, I guess when you've had some success, you make some money and then you start investing it and then you start realizing you know nothing. Yeah. I mean, you think you're going to know everything, right? Because this can't be too hard. And then you realize that you're a complete noob. And then I had the realization that, well, if I kind of screw this up, then that's a really dumb thing to do. So best thing to do is to park ego at the door, which as an entrepreneur isn't always easy. I just started going on Twitter. I'd always liked Twitter, but I'd been a lurker, one of those. And I found people like, it's the usual story. I found like the Raouls of the world and other folk and just, but being me, I started reaching out to people, trying to talk to them. And it's such a great community. Most people would get back and were happy to chat and then just basically learn from there. But you got to put the time in, you know, there's no magic bullets here. So.
Yeah, absolutely. So going back to what you're talking about with the bank reserves, I know we were in a conversation with Brent and Steven and I think Lynn and Luke and everyone. What were your conclusions there? I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I think you and I kind of saw it the same way.
I've watched that video on the weekend, but I was more interested in some ways in the one, I think, a week or two back when it was kind of funny because you put out a video at the same time, maybe it was 2 days after, but you'd obviously already come to the realization that we'll talk about. And I came to very similar conclusions, and I think Brent did as well. But it still puts us in this funny place where really smart people are sort of still kind of disagreeing if you ask them point blank questions. So the most obvious question is that I've seen come up a lot is basically let's just simplify this to US depository banks. Can they buy treasuries using their reserves? And everyone I've spoken to unequivocally says the answer is yes. They can, they do. They don't like reserves because they make 10 bips on them and they want to earn more. So now and this is based on having spoken to, for example, treasurers at large regional banks who are not primary dealers. There's a theory that maybe primary dealer banks are different. I don't think that to be the case. I've spoken to people who have worked at those. And the way it was often described to me is these reserves are a bit of a hot potato that people, the banks are trying to pass to each other. You can't get rid of them. Really only the central bank can do that. And they're really not relevant for lending at the moment. There are no reserve requirements.
Right.
Jay Powell got rid of those. I think it was in early March. And and so right now, the one thing I think everyone is agreeing on, though, and this will be whatever kind of camp you're in, is that the number one thing to be looking at is the lending data. I've heard from several people that work in large banks that are huge commercial industrial lenders just saying there's just very little demand right now. And they tell me that they don't, it makes no difference how many reserves they have, whether they can lend or not. It's an entirely a commercial decision. And, you know, and they point me towards the senior loan officer survey, which is one thing that we've all looked at, which is slightly annoying because it's a little lagged in terms of when it comes out. I think the next one will be early November. But at the end of the day, banks are deciding, don't have that much demand for lending, and right. They're deciding not to lend. So that's why if you look at the famous H8 table every week, you know, you're not seeing, apart from the initial spike we all saw when everyone pulled their revolvers, it's just been downhill since then.
Do you want to explain to the viewer who might not have followed the back and forth on Twitter why it matters if commercial banks or primary dealers can buy treasuries at auction with bank reserves, or if they have to use the, we'll call it quote unquote cash on their balance sheet, that I think is also a liability of the Fed.
Right. So yes, that's correct. Yeah. So, I mean, let's keep it really simple. So if you have to use cash to buy something, then there's going to be less of that cash circulating because you've just used it to buy it. If you can use reserves, which you can't use to buy a coffee at Starbucks, I mean, you know, JP Morgan can't take their whatever reserves card, which they don't have anyway, to Starbucks and spend it. I don't think anyone's disagreeing on that. So if you can use reserves, it means you don't need to use cash, which means that you won't be reducing the M2, i.e. the money supply. And so that's why it's important. It all comes into this deflation-inflation debate, which, again, I was, like all things, it kind of ends up being more nuanced than one originally kind of thought.
Way more nuanced.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's for sure. And I think what's so fascinating for me is realizing how much of this question is kind of up in the air, even for people who are incredibly intelligent and do this for a living, and how to figuring that out is so critical to form an opinion on whether the future is inflationary or deflationary. I think a lot of people that are even relatively sophisticated have a view on, okay, you know, we're going to definitely get stagflation or definitely hyperinflation or definitely deflation, but they don't really understand how quantitative easing works. They don't understand how it works with the primary dealer banks. They don't really understand how, like, money is created by the commercial banking system and how deposits in the real economy can be created by several different things. But the biggest cross current, if you will, is that, or the additional loans or the repayment of those loans. And, you know, they're coming to conclusions with incomplete information. I think you'd agree with that, wouldn't you?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the number one thing is people who are sure one way or the other. If there's one thing I've learned in macro, is never be sure.
Right.
You know, it's Murphy's Law. If something can go wrong, it will go wrong. And that does apply to your portfolio too. So I don't need to, why do I need to be sure right now? I think it's impossible right now to be sure. I mean, for example, if I have a lot of respect for the guys at Hedgeye, and, you know, they do a lot of analysis, and they're broadly 50-50 right now, which way, broadly. I don't think anyone can know for sure, but right. That doesn't mean so. But being at the end of the day, investing is a game of probabilities. So if you think it's 50-50, position accordingly. If you think it's 80-20, whichever way, position that accordingly. That's kind of how I look at it.
Yeah. And then you take it a step further, and it's how do you define deflation, or how do you define inflation? Just define it as the my groceries going up, but then that's a kind of an incomplete analysis. Some people would define it by, you know, asset prices. Who knows? It's
right. And look, I mean, the purist, and then we're kind of getting on the point where the ice gets thin, right? Whatever I next say, someone will disagree. But the purist will talk about the, you know, increase in M2 or money supply. Someone like say Jeff Snyder would be, groceries are going up, sure. But by the way, you don't notice a bunch of stuff going down. I mean, if you live in New York right now, your rent will be going down next time you renegotiate. So then that's, by the way, a bigger cost than groceries for most people. So it's easy to cherry pick. And of course, I think one thing that everyone also does agree on is that it's very hard to trust how inflation is measured by any government around the world. Again, whether you're in the shadow stats camp or not, for me, what matters are the trends. And if you keep methodologies constant, then that's fine. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the exact numbers, I think, you know, we all know whether it's unemployment rates, inflation rates, the governments, and it's not a US phenomenon. This is across the world. And again, it doesn't matter if a government's left or right leaning, that they're always going to try and massage things in their interest.
Yeah, that's for sure. So speaking of governments and kind of their pursuing their self-interest, I know in that text you sent me, you talked about government digital currency or cryptocurrency, mm-hmm. whatever you want to call it. And I know you've got some strong opinions on that. You've done some research. So that's a hot topic for sure with my audience. Let's dive into that and try to unpack.
So I'm bound to make friends now, right? So, so let's start with the facts, right? Which we think are facts. The facts are that out of the large countries, let's just ignore tiny countries right now. But if we're talking about the kind of G7 plus China in terms of the size, then the Chinese government is much further ahead than anyone else. They're already in trials of some form of central bank currency, and they're using Alibaba, Tencent, who own the payment rails in the US, in China, along with the major banks. This is already being rolled out at a small scale, but it's happening. And we know that people like Mark Carney, just as he left his famous Jackson Hole speech that didn't go down so well in the US, is talking about how the rest of the world's not so happy about the US hegemony. There's a good reason for why central banks, so most notably UK, Australia, we know the Fed's looking at it, but everyone's looking at this. Now, this is now where you've got to kind of start tuning your conspiracy theory monitor to, you know, if you want to turn it up to 11. And it may be that we should be turning it up to 11, because at the end of the day, this is linked, of course, to reserve currency of the world, the reserve assets of the world, but central banks... there's one thing governments seem to be pretty agreeing on right now, is they want to get rid of cash, and COVID's a fantastic opportunity. And in Asia, it was very organic. I live in Hong Kong, and just without the government saying anything, people were like, we don't want your cash. It could be dirty. So literally, and this happened all across Asia first. I don't know if it's a phenomenon happening elsewhere. But the government didn't do anything to encourage this. It just happened. And it's exactly what a government would like, because, you know, the less cash used, the more they can track. And when you and I both have a central bank account, which we will have one day, then by definition, and if cash is in effect not used, they can track everything we do. And this is getting very 1984. But then I think it's someone like Richard Werner that goes down an interesting path now, which is, he's really got some fair points, which is, central banks ultimately are either the regulator or one of the regulators that regulate the major banks in each country. Some countries have very complex regulatory regimes. But, you know, just take the US. The Fed is quite obviously a major regulator of banks. And they're going to give all of us, and not just us as individuals, but every corporate, every company, a Fed account. And they're going to start competing against the banks that they regulate. And I don't see why politicians right now are going to have an issue with that, when they just think they're going to get more control. And ultimately, though, if this does get very 1984, there's only one way it gets solved, which is at the ballot box, with maybe a younger generation who can vote more and more. I mean, in just this election in the US, you know, all millennials can vote, and some Gen Z can vote for the first time. And you know, ultimately, if this stuff is too Big Brother, that's how it should get resolved. But they may have destroyed the banking sector before this. If anything, we need more banks now, not less. That's probably one of the big issues we've had in the last 10 years. So many banks have had to shut down due to excess regulation and just not having the economies of scale.
Don't you think a lot of the millennial and Gen Z, they're the younger kids that are voting now, they just don't really get bothered by kind of the Big Brother stuff that you and I might be caught up with? It just seems like they kind of grew up with just, of course, you give all your information to the internet, or if you're not doing anything wrong, then why should you be concerned with it? It just makes life easier for the government or for Facebook or whomever to have all my data.
Yeah, so I get that. I really deeply get that, because one of my first businesses was in esports, and millennial, and so in effect, I'm theoretically like the oldest millennial possible, but everyone that knows me will laugh because I'm like basically quite blatantly a boomer. yeah, millennials, Gen Z, they absolutely understand the value of a Fortnite buck or a skin in Counter-Strike or whatever it might be. And they know that all this stuff's being tracked by the big games companies. Now, having said that, millennials are now also getting, they're in their 30s, they're starting to have families, they're starting to pay significant amounts of tax. And, often people's views change from their 20s to their 30s when they start having a family and they have more responsibilities. And so, we'll see. I mean, yes, it's if these generations never care, then I suspect governments will be able to get away with any amount of data collection for generations.
Yeah. I mean, what comes to mind is, I remember, I was born in 73, and my father was very, very old, to say the least, when I was born. And, my mom was young, my dad was really old. So, he was definitely old school, to the point where he never even used a credit card. He didn't trust them. He didn't think they would always work. So he always just traveled around with cash in his back pocket. That's just how he operated. And I think about today when I go into a bank in the United States, like a Wells Fargo or a B of A, and I don't know how they are in Hong Kong, but here, I mean, you can't deposit $5 without them asking you, where'd you get the money? Like, why are you depositing it in your account? Or all these, 40 different questions. And I just think back to the day with my father. If a bank would have asked him where he got the cash, he would have
lost it.
Of the head. Yeah, he would have totally lost his mind.
He would bank with a different bank.
Yeah, he just would not have put up with that. It was just, it's none of your effing business is what he would have said. And he probably would have said a heck of a lot more than that. But and now people, they ask all these questions, and I hear patrons of the bank and customers walking out not caring and even indulging and they're so nice and they really care about where I got the money, and that was so nice of them to ask. And I'm just like, what are you doing here? But I don't know. I hope you're right. I hope you're right, because I want to have faith that there's going to be some pushback in this.
Right. And I'm also, I think I'm realistic, but I'm generally pretty optimistic on the human race. Like, I don't believe we're in some pending loop and everything, everyone's going to die and some crazy thing happening. we've shown to be very resourceful over long periods of time. But right. There are obviously periods of time where we have issues as a human race.
Good point.
And I mean, look, we can go different ways now, right? Because now this can easily lead into what's going to be like reserve currencies in the future. It could also lead to, for example, if UBI becomes a thing, and one could argue maybe it already is, but again, younger generations may be like, well, I love the government because, I to your point, like, I don't care that they have all this data on me because they're giving me money every month, and I can, in effect, not work that hard. But one could also argue there's a point as a society is so productive, everyone doesn't need to work. And people can pursue much more creative aspects. I think luckily it is possible to travel ahead in time. It's not possible to travel back in time, except we haven't quite got a technology to travel a long way ahead in time yet. But if we were to only go 100 or 200 years, I'd be pretty surprised if everyone would need to be working all the time just to kind of produce things that, you know, that we need. I think there'll be a lot more creativity.
For people who are saying this guy's nuts, that's actually very true. And it has to do with gravity. Gravity affects time. So as an example, if you were able to survive in the gravitational pull of a, let's say, a black hole, and you're looking at the United States, if 5 seconds went by in your time, that would be like you'd see the world like 500 years.
Correct. It's in Interstellar. And by the way, Interstellar's when they're on the big planet and it's got the water and time's in effect flying by for them in relation to other times. A lot of Interstellar was very accurate from a physics standpoint. So it's not actually crazy. In fact, if you drive your car, you're actually going forward in time relative to other people because you're going faster than them. But it's just, it's such a tiny, tiny, tiny thing that you can't really notice.
I'll shelf that because that's going to take us down a whole different path. But let's go back in the conversation to what you were talking about with everyone is going to have an account with the Fed. So unpack that. And let's explore why that's a really, really big deal from a standpoint of bank reserves. And as Dr. Lacey Hunt would say, turning bank reserves into legal tender. And then also from a standpoint of Big Brother.
Right. So right now, we have to, whilst people can argue about what the mechanism is for how quantitative easing gets into the real economy or not, you don't need to have that argument if we all have a Fed account. Because if the Fed can literally press a button and give me and you $1,000 or $100,000 or $1 million or whatever, and it appears there, and we can freely go and spend that on our phone, in a Starbucks, in a whatever, and it works. As far as Starbucks is concerned, this is a US dollar.
Yeah.
Now, it's still fiat money. There's nothing kind of super clever about it, really. And for those that like blockchain, they'll be saying, well, this won't be decentralized. And no, it won't. It will be a database held by the government. Mm-hmm. And if you do something bad and they decide they're going to change your entry, you will suddenly have less money.
In a database where they see every single transaction.
Correct. They control it. Yeah. So now some people say, well, that's great because that means the Fed can directly put money into people's bank accounts. Now if we go down the Dr. Hunt kind of angle, I think most people get that politicians are generally not going to be people that say no to spending more, just seemingly how the world, I mean, that was different 20 years ago. I remember these debates, but and so are they going to press that button or not? Of course they will. And so, you know, one can see how there's a nice argument if all that happens for having some significant inflation of the money supply and prices, and however you want to look at it, you know, to have inflation.
Yeah. How do you think velocity plays into that? Because in my mind, if they have control, that much control, then they could say, you got to spend the money within 30 days or it's gone.
Yeah, exactly. Something like that. Yeah. That's the little cherry on top, right? I mean, they could, here's $10,000. You must spend it in 30 days, else it literally goes away. Oh, by the way, if that doesn't work, spend it in 10 days. If it doesn't work, spend it in 10 hours. Oh, we actually want you to spend more money. We want to help the retail sector because JCPenney's shut down and whatever. Well, you know what? You have to spend it in JCPenney. This can all be done because what you've really done is you've made money non-fungible. So a dollar bill is a dollar bill is a dollar bill. You can use it wherever. But actually, if the dollar bill basically has code on it that says, well, you can only use it here, then you've made money non-fungible. I don't think we have any clue what ramifications that will have in the long run, because that's never been tried before.
Boy, yeah, that's a great point. And talk about a misallocation of resources.
I mean, yeah, you get, in effect, bureaucrats and governments deciding that one can argue now that probably the most convincing argument why we're in a, you know, there's a lot of deflationary pressures right now is the misallocation of capital because nothing's allowed to go bust. And many people say capitalism is dead, and which is sad because, you know, America's, and maybe even most acutely in America, which is really sad considering it's been one of the, you know, engines of innovation of the world for the last 100 years or more.
That's, I see that potentially affecting the supply side, but affecting the demand side as far as the direction that the demand is placed. I mean, I think through like a social score, like we've heard talk about in China, and how if the Fed, I mean, taking another step, I'm just thinking out loud, if we all had accounts with the Fed and they were competing with the commercial banking system for lending, then you could get a car loan or a home loan, as an example, directly from the Fed, in which case because they can take an unlimited haircut on those loans because they're not really hampered by profit and loss like the commercial banking system. So they wouldn't have to necessarily give loans based on credit score or give loans based on the probability of the individual paying them back. They could make it almost exclusively on a social credit score.
Right. And but of course, that might be the thing that tips the balance. So this does exist in China now, and it can decide whether you're allowed, ignoring COVID, which is obviously, you know, changed things for the short term, medium term, but it can decide whether you're allowed to travel somewhere or not. Okay, well, is a 26-year-old going to be very happy if they're told they can't travel somewhere because of this score or whatever it is? Now, they might be happy with the fact they're getting money, but then suddenly their freedoms have gone. I mean, the problem is I don't have much confidence that the politicians can navigate this delicate balance in an entirely new area that is gigantic. I mean, we can't even know if a recession's coming. I mean, how many economists predict recessions? The answer is almost none. Yeah. We live in such a ridiculously complex, interconnected world. You know, are politicians going to get this just right and get, you know, all the knobs they can turn either way? Are they going to? I don't think so. But again, ultimately, that's why democracy is important. We solve at the ballot box. It may take a long time. So.
This podcast is brought to you by Rebel Capitalist Pro, the best online investing research. I have teamed up with Chris McIntosh and Lynn Alden, two of the best in the business, to create Rebel Capitalist Pro and give you the tools you need to build wealth and thrive in this crazy world of economic insanity. Rebel Capitalist Pro is jam-packed with Chris and Lynn's incredible research. We have live stream Q&As where you can ask your questions directly to Chris, Lynn, and myself. And the best of all, there's an online member forum which allows you to network, learn, and explore ideas with like-minded individuals. What are you waiting for? Check out Rebel Capitalist Pro right now at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. Take action today and do something your future self will thank you for.
Yeah, it's a great point. We're dealing with a complex system with the economy. And I always look at it, it's very much like nature. You know, you always hear those stories about like in Florida or something, when there's too many insects, they bring in the frogs. And the next thing you know, the frog problem's like 10 times bigger. Then they bring in alligators to the frogs, and the alligator problem's even bigger than the frog problem. And I think it's the exact same thing with the economy, or anytime a politician tries to kind of micromanage that and turn that dial, you're always going to get those unintended consequences.
And this is like an unpopular view I have, but some people like it, some others don't, which is that this is all because we have very short political cycles. So one could argue in the US it's a 2-year cycle just because of how the Senate and the House, and that does change things. So you could argue it's a 2 or 4 year cycle, doesn't really matter. It's still a short period of time. The UK has a 5-year cycle. Most of Europe, most of the world is between 3 to 5 year political cycles. Of course, there are exceptions to this, whether it be China and other countries. And I'm not suggesting everyone should have longer cycles, because I'm a firm believer in having, you know, that kind of check on democracy every few years. But it does mean it's incredibly hard to plan for the future in the long run. Everything and everything's become so, you know, partisan and of the moment, that things like, you know, retirement age and things that do require 30 years thinking ahead get very swept under the carpet. And that's another giant problem that is being talked about a lot less this year. But the problem hasn't gone away. So.
Yeah, I mean, when you're talking about that, Singapore is the first place that comes to mind. And that, it can work. If you got the right guy or gal in charge, it can work. The problem is when you're centralizing that much power, eventually you're going to get the wrong guy or gal potentially. And then you got real right. problems.
And also, centralized. And also Singapore, I love Singapore, but it's 7 million people, very similar to Hong Kong. Oh, it's right. small geographically. Yep. It just compared to the complexity of, say, just the US, or indeed you could argue Europe as, you know, an amalgamation of a federation of countries. Mm-hmm. What works in a country of 5 to 10 million could be a Sweden or whatever, right? Or New Zealand. It doesn't necessarily work in, you know, the US or China or India, you know. Right. As you have literally, you know, two magnitudes difference in population levels, it's not so easy.
Yeah, I mean, you'd know just as well as I do that it's just like running a business. And mm-hmm. people think, if you're just good at quote unquote business, you're always going to be good. That's not necessarily the case, because running a business with 10 employees is wildly different than running one with 100, which is wildly different than running one with 1,000. It's a completely different ballgame. And one person might be good at one thing, you know, maybe a small startup, and they're horrible at running a business with more than maybe 20 employees.
Yeah. I always said there's three numbers. There's about 20 to 30, just like you said. That's when everyone doesn't suddenly work for a founder. The next number is called the Dunbar number. It's about 130. No one knows exactly what it is, but it's when everyone doesn't know each other. And the more locations you're in, the lower the number, because it's harder to know people in different locations. And then the next number is about 500, where if you're not really a corporation and you don't have a lot of process, it's just going to fall apart and be a mess, whatever happens.
Yeah.
And some people, like Jeff Bezos, have been incredible at getting through all those. It's actually pretty rare. Most people are going to suck at least one of those three, or maybe two out of the three.
Yep.
I know for myself, I'm not good at the 500 plus big company thing. I'm just not good at that. But I much prefer the earlier stages and working things out, setting them up.
Same here. And I was fortunate that I recognized that about my personality very early. Exactly. And for me, kind of the line in the sand was always, if we're at the point where we need an HR department, it's time for me to check out.
Right.
I just can't deal with HR and just the, you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah. If you need a department, you need one person, but if it suddenly becomes a whole department, then you're at hundreds of people. Yeah, for sure.
Exactly. Okay. So you're in Hong Kong right now. I'm not sure how long you've lived there, but I'd really love to get your take on kind of the dynamic and what's going on even prior to COVID, when they were having the protests and whatnot, what the relationship is with China, how you see that evolving in the future, and then maybe layer over top. I don't know if you're familiar with Kyle Bass's position on the Hong Kong dollar and Hong Kong in general, and HSBC and the real estate market there. If you could expand on that, kind of boots on the ground, that'd be awesome.
Sure. So I've been here 5 years. So that puts me very much in the middle. You know, there's a lot of people who've been here, expats, 20, 30 years. And in that 5 years, I mean, there have definitely been some changes. So if I base upon people I talk to, I think there's kind of three categories of person. There's expats, which is a very small amount, right? You're talking 1 or 2% of the population. And they tend to be, you know, if something affects them individually, they tend to be people who can just move somewhere else. So they're not very relevant in, and they also don't own much property. And the whole Hong Kong economy is based on property. And if you are an expat living here, you know why people don't own, because the prices are insane. I mean, literally they're like, you're talking like 3-4x more than New York or prime London. Like it's absolutely nuts.
Yeah.
So, and then the two other categories are, basically, Hong Kong people that do have foreign passports in countries which they might want to live in. And so really that is mainly Canada, UK, US, Australia are the big ones. They dwarf everything else. And then you've got local residents that don't have other passports. So local residents that do tend to be more relaxed, because they do know if they really need to, they can probably go somewhere else if they need to. And they already have those support networks elsewhere and infrastructure. And that's a not insignificant amount of the population. But for those, especially younger folk who, say you're a student and, you know, the Hong Kong economy is really, it's about real estate, it's about financial services. This might not interest you. And so, you know, what are you going to do? Now, you could say, well, look, you should speak Mandarin, which you may or may not do, by the way. And if you do, why don't you hop over to Shenzhen, which is literally, you know, 45 minutes away, 20 minutes on the fast train now, and be an entrepreneur in China. Now, people may not be that inclined, right? So I can see if you're, you know, in your kind, if you're young and not from a wealthy family, it could be very hard to think, well, what is my future going to be? Where can I go? You know, what am I really going to do? And so, you know, Hong Kong is, I mean, this is not saying anything people don't know, but I mean, it's got a huge Gini coefficient, right? The difference between the have and the have nots is as large as anywhere. So with the protests, you know, I think most locals here were not happy with it, especially ones I spoke to, because it was disrupting Hong Kong. And most people's view was, well, look, at the end of the day, there's a 50-year agreement with the UK. We're basically halfway through. We don't know what will happen in 2047, but that's a fair way away. And these protests are like not helping the economy at all. This was pre-COVID, remember. So Hong Kong's had the protests, which it was already having the minus 30% retail sales numbers before COVID hit. And then I think when COVID came and just went everywhere, of course, like, you know, the world was a little distracted, to say the least. And but equally, you know, China wanted to, it was clearly not something China wanted in terms of having these protests going on. And at some point, I mean, everyone would know in 2047, the law would be exactly this. At some point it was going to change. It just changed basically 25 years earlier. Some people get very wound up by that. Some people don't. It's a very emotive subject here. You don't bring this up with a bunch of people you don't know for kind of happy-go-lucky conversation. That's kind of like having the Trump-Biden debate or Brexit debate.
It's like Trump.
You know, same in UK with Brexit. So, but in terms of the Hong Kong dollar, so I take the total opposite view to Kyle, which is that, you know, to be clear, I do not keep many assets in Hong Kong dollars, because what's the point? I may as well keep them in US dollars. I mean, and it's pegged at about 7.8, there's several hundred billion dollars in HKMA that can be used, which is the equivalent of the Fed, in effect, can be used to strengthen the Hong Kong dollar if required. And actually, in the last year, they've tended to be selling Hong Kong dollars because it's been strong. So having said that, and by the way, not many people can actually make the trade, because most retail platforms will not allow you to buy put or call options on the Hong Kong US dollar spread. But if you do have access to that trade, because the volatility is next to zero, the upside is absolutely gigantic if you got it right.
Right.
But it's a very specialist trade. And, you know, Kyle is not like investing half his fund into this one trade. I mean, it's similar to, say, Brent, who might be long US dollar, but there's many, many, many other things that, you know, are in the portfolio. HSBC was the other question, and you know, probably Standard Chartered too. You know, they're kind of two, but HSBC has about, I think, about an 80% share of banking here for commercial and retail. It's kind of crazy.
I did a whiteboard video on it, and I saw that along with their exposure to the real estate market. Then yes. I just started, you know, you think it through, okay, if real estate goes down because of a protest or maybe COVID, you know, they've just got massive exposure to that. And it's so they got all their eggs in one basket.
Right. So, yes. And also HSBC in Hong Kong is an entirely separate balance sheet to the UK HSBC.
Oh, really?
Even though it's a subsidiary, it's actually segregated.
Okay.
Legally segregated. So, i.e. one could go bust and the other doesn't.
Ah, I didn't know that.
And so this is where people, I think, need to understand a little bit more about the psychology in China and Hong Kong on real estate. Neither government in China or Hong Kong can allow to have a massive crash. It's just socially not going to be acceptable. So I think that would be the last standing will still be probably the property markets.
How do you think they'd prevent that?
They will exhaust. How's the Fed preventing all sorts of stuff right now? If you want to create enough money and in both countries, that money can be quite tough. In fact, even more targeted where it's flowing versus in the West. And there are very well-known zombie companies in China that in real estate, like Evergrande, which if you looked at their debt to EBITDA ratios, people would have a heart attack. But again, they've been around a long time. They can still raise money. And, I'm putting the Chinese market together with the Hong Kong market. They're very interrelated. If that went down, really, that's the entire economy is done. That would be like the service sector in some ways going down in the US, like forever. It doesn't mean we won't get there. It's just that's going to be the last thing to fall.
All right. Well, one thing I really wanted to talk to you about, and I know you, I don't know if you specialize in this, but I've heard you talk about it just recently on a podcast episode where you talk about options.
Yeah.
And going long volatility. Mm-hmm. And I know that that's just such a hot topic right now because of Chris Pohl's work. And I get that question all the time because I'm always talking about the future being volatile, not only in markets, but socially as well. And I say from a social standpoint, it's a little easier to go long volatility. You can always have an RV parked in your driveway a passport or something, have a boat to go to St. Bart's. But to have your portfolio long volatility, much, much harder to do. So could you give us some insights on if you do that, how do you do it? And is there any way to make this? I know there's no way to make it easy, but is there a way to make it easier?
Yeah. So, first thing to understand is that most investments people have, if you own stock market or bonds or whatever, they're basically short volatility. And so, what that means is that most people in most of their investments, they don't have a kind of, let's just call it an insurance policy. It's really what long volatility is. It's an insurance policy for if a bunch of stuff happens, like in March.
Would you consider gold long vol or not?
Let's see. This is a little bit more tricky. So because again, gold has different correlations. So for example, in March, first of all, it went up, then it went down, right? When everything went down apart from the US dollar. So sometimes people, you've got to be very aware when you think about volatility that correlations they can change, and they can change ridiculously quickly. And they did in 08, and they did just now. So it shouldn't have surprised people, but it did. The only way to, if you want to make money when the stock market goes down, well, you have to be short the stock market. That's the surefire way, versus, say being long gold, because gold might go down too. But in terms of volatility itself, I think Chris Cole's work's excellent. Eric Townsend and Patrick Sreznor have said a lot on this too, to try and make it simple for a retail investor. So the really annoying thing here, there are these VIX products like the VXX and the VXY, which I've seen a lot of people recently on Twitter saying, oh, I'm just buying and holding those. Well, if you put $1 million into the VXX 10 years ago, it would now be worth $1. So you would have lost because every month you're losing about 6% or so. So I can't.
Why is that? Can you outline that for the average? We're talking about because it can tag go and because there's a negative carry there.
Yeah, because you've got right now, and even if you ignore the election, you've got all these products are based upon VIX futures. The VXX, which I think is the most popular, is using the next 2 months. So current month and next month. And every day they move more of it more of the exposure from this month into the next month. So it's not like a step function. Like you remember the USO issues with oil it's not like it's more sophisticated than that, but it means that because the market's contango, i.e. the curve is going up in terms of for longer dated VIX futures, you're paying more. That means when it rolls, it's literally an exponential decay curve if you look at it over 10 years. Now, if you can time it, like bang on, like if you bought this in early Feb, then you would have made incredible returns. But it makes it all about timing. So the easier way to do it does require the ability to trade options. And if you can't trade options, then it's you basically have to use these other products, which I just think are suboptimal. So the main ways people go long volatility, again, keeping it simple, are buying things like straddles. So you buy, for example, let's see, the S&P is at about, well, the SPY, which is a very liquid options market. And that's important. You've got to make sure the markets are liquid. It's at about 340. So you can buy a call and a put with the same strike, 340, with the same expiry, say, June next year. And if, so the SPY will go up or down, but something's going to happen. You will lose if it just exactly stays where it is. But if volatility goes up, both the call and the put will actually be worth more. And if it goes up or down a long way, as in the actual underlying, then that one will actually be worth far more than the other one is going down. And so this is a pretty pure way of getting access to volatility. People use what's called, so you can use ratio spreads and do the same. Mm-hmm. So for example, you could buy, an interesting one recently has been like NASDAQ, right? Or XLK is sort of the a similar thing. Where you might sell, and this is starting to sell an option. So again, this is not for people who have never traded options. So you might sell one XLK contract at 100, and that will give you a premium that allows you to buy, say, three at 120 or two at 120. Right. Yep. And depending on the gap between those two will tell you how many you can buy. Now, the more you buy, the more upside you have. And so this gives you a... it means you can lose more money than you put in, but there's a flaw to it. But again, if volatility goes up, you're basically long more things than you're short. So it goes up in value. So they're the kind of main ways. Or another, probably the simplest way is just people, they talk about LEAPS, so long-term equity appreciation options. These are just options that are, say, 9 months or more in expiry. And if you can buy them when volatility is low, so you don't want to be buying volatility like a week ago when the VIX was at 40. You want to be buying it
expensive, like anything else. It's right. There's cheap and expensive, yeah.
Of course. And so interesting. So I think it was about 2 months ago on one of my podcasts, I said, look, like gold volatility has got really low. It was down to like 14, which was pretty much where it was in 2019. And you know, the chart, everyone knows the gold chart looks great. Volatility had gone down. So I'm like, hey, this is probably a good time to lock in that low volatility with really long dated call options.
Right.
And now, through complete luck, that trade worked within days, but that was luck. But I haven't sold any of them because now we're at a slightly higher vol regime. It obviously had gone a lot higher. And then you get like the double kicker of the gold price had gone up and the volatility had gone up. And so the long dated options are nice because you can also all of the above. If you trade them longer term, like 6 to 12 months expiry, you can roll them when you've got maybe 2 to 3 months left, because you're going to get most of what's called the theta burn. So the time decay is going to get most at the end of the option's life. So I don't recommend retail people are mucking around with like 2 to 3 week options all the time. It's just too much to manage.
Yeah. Where would you suggest people go to learn about this?
I haven't found, like, in terms of free resources, I haven't found like a kind of gold standard. There are books which are incredibly dry and
I can imagine. Yeah.
And very thick and very hard to even get hold of these days. When a book is not on a Kindle, then you know there's a problem. So I think YouTube is still finding the right people on YouTube. There are a bunch of people that really do. They tend to have the word volatility in their kind of name. And
on the channel name?
Pardon?
In the channel name?
Yeah. And you can generally tell, look, if someone has done 100 videos on volatility, it's fairly likely they have some idea what they're talking about. But other areas, I think Real Vision has done a lot of stuff with, whether it's look out for people like Chris Cole, and then you've got Mike has been, and Mike does a lot of straddles, by the way. So just as like one of the first thing I was talking about. And then you've got Matt Rowe, and then you've got Mutiny Capital. These are a lot of the big players in the Vol space. And they do quite a lot of podcasts and things here and there. Mutiny has their own podcast, for example. Mm. And the nice thing is about that is just because their podcast is, say, from a year ago, well, the fundamentals haven't changed in terms of what trades you could make. I mean, of course, the macro environment's changed. But you've got to put the time in. And the number one thing I always say to people is, start with buying one of something. Now, with an option, one is 100, right? Because you're actually buying exposure to 100 of the underlying. So don't do it with Amazon shares because they're $3,000 a share. But just buy something that's very cheap. And if it goes wrong, it really doesn't matter. And never, ever sell options unless you really know what you're doing. Because that's when you can have unlimited downside. If you buy options, you can only ever lose what you put in. So it's a rabbit hole, just like reserves and Bitcoin and whatever.
So, okay, you talked about Bitcoin. Let's go into that. We discussed the reserve or the dollar, potentially the Fed coin, if you want to call it that. Yeah. We're all going to have these accounts at the Federal Reserve where we can take bank reserves, and that goes into legal tender, and they're Big Brother. They're monitoring every transaction, kind of guiding demand. But how does Bitcoin play into that? Does Bitcoin kind of allow us to check out of the system, or do you think they're going to ban it and it's going to become like heroin, where you might be able to use it, but the downside, as far as a prison term, is so great that people will just avoid using it? Or how do you think that plays out?
Well, first of all, I'm biased because I've owned Bitcoin for 6 or 7 years. And I don't trade it. I just let it sit there and just don't care. So I'm biased. And again, like, I think when people disclose their biases, it's always helpful. Now, I also try and be realistic on this. So I do not think Bitcoin is going to be like some magical world reserve currency, replacing the US dollar for actual FX transactions. There's technical reasons why right now it couldn't even do it. But let's assume, we've got to remember, it's just software, right? So, you know, if we think back to early versions of, Microsoft Windows, well, they didn't do much. And now Windows does a lot more. So a lot of people forget that it can evolve in terms of functionality. And there are thousands of people who are very, very smart working on it. It's popular for people to say, well, yes, the government's just going to come and ban it. Yeah, maybe. Again, if the more and more, the younger generations who have vastly higher ownership of digital assets than older generations are voting more and more and more, ultimately, again, it gets decided at the ballot box. You know, if 20, 30 year olds do not want this banned, why on earth would a government ban it? They're going to get chucked out. So I think once you go through the whole Fed or Bank of England or whatever you want to call it coin, people see that there's more Big Brotherness happening.
Right.
Whether people really understand what's all going on, I wouldn't be surprised if people do gravitate towards something that's outside of the main system. And people have done this for a long time with gold. Let's not get into silver, palladium, all the other stuff. But if you just take gold, it used to be part of the system and then it kind of wasn't. Could argue we've had a 50-year experiment, that might get laughed at in the future. So I think alternatives are good. It does have one phenomenal property, which is, again, one can argue what it's worth all day, and you could argue what an ounce of gold is worth all day. At the end of the day, I think it will become the most kind of pristine collateral that you can have in the world, because it's instantly transferable. You cannot pledge it twice. You can wrap a contract around it, software that means if it's pledged as collateral in one place, it's not possible to pledge it elsewhere, which is absolutely not the case right now. It's called rehypothecation of collateral. It happens all the time in the world.
Yep.
And in Asia, it's super bad, by the way. It's not uncommon for someone to pledge a collateral 5-10 times. Well,
I'm sorry to cut you off there, but so you can't rehypothecate it, nor, and it's a fixed supply. You got 21 million, right. And also, and it sounds crazy, or it sounds kind of funny to say it, but that's a reducing, that it's a decreasing supply because people just lose them.
Yeah, they So first of all, on the rehypothecation, so to be clear, if you just say to someone, I have some Bitcoin, well, of course you could tell 28 other people you have some Bitcoin. But if you actually put it in a software contract that it's called a smart contract, and this can be done. This is where Ethereum comes into it, by the way. You can wrap the Bitcoin with the contract, and actually both sides can audit the software, and you know it can be open source, and it can absolutely be used as nice collateral. And so yeah, there's 21 million. Now no one knows how many has already been lost, but most estimates are of the order of 2, 3, or 4 million is probably never coming back.
It is always going to be more and more and more lost.
Correct. It's possible to unlock. You can find a key, but it's fairly unlikely. But it is possible you could find a piece of paper, or you could find a digital file or whatever that has something. So they're probably going to end up being about 17 million that actually circulate. And, you know, this is where, you know, I'm pretty much as my positions in gold and Bitcoin are about the same in terms of dollar value. So like, yeah. I'm like, I don't have a bone in this fight. Like, I don't care which wins, or if indeed maybe they both win or maybe they both lose. But the ultimate issue with gold is that there is a pseudo infinite amount in the universe. Now, it doesn't mean we can access it, and we might not be able to access it for decades or hundreds of years. But even in our solar system, there's much more than, in fact, just in the Earth, there's a huge amount more than we've mined. With Bitcoin, it literally is that amount, and it's not going to go more. Now, people say, oh, that could just change. But to change that number would need every constituent part of the Bitcoin ecosystem to economically screw themselves, which is just not going to happen. Mm. So I feel much more comfortable that that won't change versus, if a government was in charge, of course, they'll change it tomorrow. There are people like Raul who's called it being irresponsibly long Bitcoin. And it's by far his largest position. He has said, you know, roughly where it is. And he's literally above 50%.
Wow. I didn't know that.
And it's actually more, but again, I'm not recommending like that's a position everyone should have. I mean, but he's looked into it a lot. And thinks it's the best macro trade right now. There are plenty of people that would put gold in that bucket too, right? A lot of people long gold, which is what gives me pause in some ways because everyone's long it. If Bitcoin is the world's most pristine collateral, because you can move it easily, you can't move gold bars easily. It doesn't matter what anyone says. You know, yes, there are ways you could. It becomes accounting entries again. And you can move Bitcoin. It absolutely, you can use software. It's in a way that allows you to protect that collateral. Younger generations get it. They've always understood the value of digital stuff in a way that older generations haven't. And it's got the network effect as of now. That doesn't mean it will in 10 years. But also the Lindy effect, I think, is important. You know, it's been around, 11 or 12 years now. You know, Bitcoin is meant to have died about 5,000 times already, and there's a website that tracks this. It's one of those big rabbit holes that when you really get into it, you tend to realize that everything hasn't been worked out yet, but there are people working on these things, and these are smart people, and at the end of the day you can change code, and when everyone in the system's working to better the system, it'd be very odd if people are doing things to make it worse. Mm-hmm. Again, just getting your mind around what decentralization really means is a very interesting topic for most people because they're not used to it. So,
yeah, absolutely. Nor are they used to nor do they understand the monetary system the way it functions right now. One could argue how broken it is if you look at the euro dollar. So there's a lot of things that they might not be interested in, or even if they were, it's very tough to get your mind around for the average person. So that's why they need to check you out on Twitter and follow all the people that we're talking about. I know we're coming right up on an hour right now, Chris. So I've really enjoyed our conversation. And if you could tell my viewers where they can learn more about what you do, you're talking about your podcast and of course your Twitter handle. Can you let everyone know where to find you?
Sure. So the easiest way is just Twitter at Darky999. My surname's Dark. So when I was a kid, everyone called me Darky. I'm aware that that may not be the best name now these days, but it was from a long time ago. My podcast is called Dr. Dark After Dark. It's on all the, it's very simple. It's either me doing a monologue for about an hour, or I get a guest like yourself, or, you know, so like Emil Kalinowski was on last week, and we have no script. We just talk. There's no editing. If someone says something silly, they say something silly, and then I get it out straight away. So within a half an hour of finishing, because it tends to be quite topical topics. That is generally on Macro. I'd say 9 out of 10 shows are, but sometimes we go kind of off the beaten track a bit. So.
Yeah, well, that's great. Everyone needs to check that out. And just in closing, one thing I was going to tell you I've written down in my notes is, I think you might find it interesting. Saturday night, I had dinner with Robert Barnes. He's a lawyer that's been on my show a few times, a free speech lawyer, constitutional lawyer. He represented Alex Jones when Alex Jones sued Twitter. And he's represented a lot of kind of high profile cases like that. And we actually talked about me hiring his firm to go through the Federal Reserve Act with a fine-tooth comb to determine what the Fed can do and what they can't do based on what's in writing. Because, again, that's a big topic on Twitter. Some people think that the Federal Reserve Act prevents the banks from using those bank reserves, but I think I might hire his firm to go through that and give us a final conclusion as to what the Federal Reserve Act actually says.
That'd be super interesting. But then, of course, you have to layer politics on top, which is, you know, who's actually going to sue the Fed? If all politicians don't want to, it's going to be incredibly hard for a third party. But someone's going to at some point. I mean, it's going to happen. It's just, are they going to have the resources? Yeah. Interesting.
So anyway, stay tuned for that, guys. on that cliffhanger. Chris, thanks again for your time. And I can't wait to do it again.
All right. Thanks, George. Bye.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.